I offer a course at California Lutheran College called World Resources. And normally it meets three times a week for a whole semester. And we're going to try and run through some of the things, the highlights of this in an hour. So obviously we're not going to get into any great depth and things, but I thought I'd go through some of the things that come up as important topics in this particular course and sort of list them for you. And then I welcome you to interrupt me at any point, because I don't have to get through this whole course, you know, today. And we can deal with what you're interested in. So if some particular topic strikes you as being interesting, why, ask questions, and we'll develop it a little further. First of all, if you talk about world resources, we approach it from the point of view of man. Now, if we were interested in world resources from the point of view of the ground squirrels or the chipmunks at Holden Village, it'd be a different subject entirely. But since we are thinking about it from man's point of view, then we'll look at what's available in the world that's useful to man. That's really what the term resource means in this instance. Now, there's a big difference between a resource, which is something that's useful to man, and a reserve, which is something in the environment that can be counted on. Something that's there can be extracted at a profit, or something that's readily available and needed. And so that concept differs as to whether you look at something as a resource, something that's possibly valuable in the future, but not necessarily going to be used today. And of course, many of the things that we really use today were resources of a long time back, but really did not become important until they actually become useful to man. So that's the concept that we want to stick with here. Now, just then, by way of that kind of general introduction, then let me just kind of list the things that we go through and try to evaluate. And I try to get my students to think in terms of at least 100 years from now into the future, and hopefully 200, 500, 1,000, or let's say 1,000,000 years from now. So what will the situation be if we continue the present trends and the knowledge of what we have of certain things that are useful and necessary today? And what's the situation going to be 100 years from now? Or even the year 2000, which you will see, and where the forecasts, you see a lot of forecasts today and publications that pretty much zero in on the year 2000. And many things come into focus when you begin to think about what the situation will be at that time. Well, I don't have all my notes here, so much of this is going to come out over the just off the top of my head. But I did go into the library just to see what some of the things are that are available here in the village, in case any of you want to dig into it. And here, for example, is a book on scarcity and growth, which I donated to the library back in the early 60s, and is still a good volume to read. And some of you may be familiar with Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful. And this is a very interesting book and a very thought-provoking book in relationship to our modern situation in terms of world resources. And one of the books in the library here is the Statistical Abstract. Now, this is very dry, statistical kinds of things, but it puts things in a very brief, succinct summary, and that's available. And the World Almanac is another one. The World Atlas in the library. And all of the United Nations publications many of them deal with the natural resources and their use and the possible supply into the future. And right now, currently at Christmas, some of my children gave me this particular book, and many of you saw this series, the Bronowski series, The Ascent of Man. And this really relates to the man's utilization of natural resources and how things developed through time as man developed a culture and then began to use all of these different things. Now let's look at some of the areas that we have to kind of prescribe in order to understand what the problem is in relationship to world reserves and world resources. First of all is population. And as you go back to the early stages of man, you see, really he lived on the things that were available at the surface, and he foraged, he hunted, and finally he began to domesticate animals and crops and settle down. And then, as you all know, man does something that's very different in the environment from any other animal, in that he utilizes power or energy to dig into the earth. And actually, the resources that are available to man are very different in that sense than they are to any other animal that lives on the surface of the earth, because he can dig down and he mines and produces things from within the earth, and he also now can travel to into space and go to other heavenly bodies. And presumably then, you see, he has enlarged in the third dimension the resources that are available to him. So this becomes an important aspect in thinking about world resources as they are available to man. But the thing in terms of the current trends that's really rather disturbing is the fact that man is increasing the population, the human population of the earth, at such a rapid pace that as you look at the year 2000 or maybe 2010, somewhere in that vicinity, there will be twice as many people on the earth as there are today. The population will double in something between 30 and 40 years from now. So if you think then in terms of what's available today and divide it in half, you see, this is the net effect. And as you think of all of the kinds of things that develop, then we have to think of one of the other basic concepts that we deal with in this, is whether a resource is exhaustible or whether it's renewable. We refer to certain resources as flow resources. The timber out here in the Holden Village area obviously is a kind of flow resource because it'll grow back and you can harvest it. So it's a renewable kind of resource. But you think on the other side of the stream here and you look across at the mine, that's an exhaustible resource, and once you've taken the ore out of the mountain, there isn't any more there. So that's a depletable kind of resource. So we have the kind of resources that renew themselves in the environment, and we have others which very definitely are depletable, and once they're gone, that's the end of it. So in terms of the population increase then, and the demand for more things, then there is a drain, you see, in terms of both the renewable and the non-renewable kinds of resources that are available to man to provide the kind of standard of living that he has and the kind of culture that he has. So population, is a basic parameter that we have to be concerned with if we project 100 years. See, I have said we double in 30 years, perhaps. Well, that means if you double again, the next 30. And what if you double again the next 30? You see, there is obviously some limit. And the question that the biologists are concerned with is how much of the biosphere can be supported, you see, by the natural materials that can be raised and provided as food, so that there is a very definite problem that we face if population continues to increase. Now that's one of the parameters we have to look at. One of the other major parameters is the availability of land, arable land. Arable land is simply land that will raise a crop that you can grow corn or wheat or rice or something that is food for man. Now, at the present time, we have about 4 billion people living on the earth. And we have about 4 billion arable acres. So for every person living on the earth today, there is one support acre. Now, at the point then, say 30, 40 years from now, when there are twice as many people, at that point, the question is, can we increase the number of acres that are arable? And the basic answer is no. You cannot do that. So the good acres that are available to raise crops are very, very definitely limited. And you can't just increase arable acres. To some degree, you can add acres that will produce crops by more irrigation and developing different kinds of strains of seeds that can live in more adverse climate. And so you can increase to some degree, but not in any great degree. And one of the other basic problems is, it goes along with these two, if you double the population, where do you put the people? Where do they live? They build houses, they build shopping centers, they build all kinds of things, and where do they build them? Basically, the easiest place to build anything is on the acreage which is best to farm. So you find that in California, where I come from, the citrus groves are being taken down and a new development is springing up, and instead of oranges, we have houses. Or instead, we have a shopping center or whatnot, you see. So if you double the people, then you're also going to impinge on the number of arable acres that are actually available from that point of view. So the net effect is that you begin to irrigate acres which are not really as productive, and you can't make as productive in order to satisfy the demand where the acreage is taken out to satisfy the urbanization, you see, in the expansion. And if you look at the population trend now, you see, when you go back to the early 1900s, almost two-thirds of the people in this country lived on farms, and they were agriculturally based. And when you come to the end of this century, the forecast is that at least two-thirds of the people will be in cities, and probably three-fourths. And only one-fourth will be living on the land as agricultural people in the way in which we think of it. So the trend is to the cities, and it's away from the farms and away from the land and so on. Well, at some point, there's going to be a food problem. Now, at this point in the United States, we do not have a food problem because we're more fortunate than the rest of the world from the point of view of our support acreage and the climatic conditions and all of that. We just happened to be in the garden spot of the world. And that's nothing that we had anything to do with, except that's the way it is. For each of us, there is 2.5 good arable acres. And for each of us, you see, then there's a surplus, actually, of food that's being produced. And we're exporting a large part of our crop to the rest of the world. And so we're one of the major suppliers of food to the rest of the world. And so from a point of view of resource, you see, when you look at a world base for resources, we are one of the major areas that can provide even more food than we do at the present time. But we're concerned when you think about the figures that we're losing each year, about 1 million acres of good land to urban spread and urban development. The new housing tracts that are going in. If you just add this up for the whole country, it adds up, you see, terrifically, because on the perimeter of every city, this kind of thing is going on. So, from the point of view of land and food, these are very basic kinds of resources that are necessary for the survival of man. Now, what does man really need in order to survive? And it gets to the point where we must think about that. Basically, what we need is sunshine. We couldn't live without sunshine. We need fresh air. We need clean water. We need food. We need some kind of source of energy for our bodies. And if we have those basic ingredients, then you see life can be sustained. But now we have problems when we begin to look at some of these areas. Because as we look at water, for example, now if you look at it worldwide, half of the people in the world, you see, do not have water at their residence, at their house, at their habitat. There's and two-thirds of the people of the world do not have clean water. And you all, those of you who travel, know this. You know, when you go to a foreign country, you're very careful about the water you drink because normally it is not clean and you can't trust it. So that just in terms of clean water, that's one of the major problems of the world. And as you may know, this coming year, there will be a world conference. There'll be a world conference in Argentina where all of the nations will come together to consider this problem, this one problem of fresh water. And one of the basic requirements that man needs to survive is clean water. And so that he has a source of healthy, clean water so that he can use this to live in as a major resource in his environment. So water is a problem. As you look at the world, you know, this is a water planet. And if you're out in space and looking at the world, that's what you see. Nothing but water, essentially. And so the Earth is the water planet. It is the life planet. But when you look at fresh water, which is what man has to have, he can't use the salt water. When you get down to that, the availability of water is less than 1% of the total of all the water on the earth is really available as fresh water. And then when you think in the United States that we have such major sources as the Great Lakes, freshwater lakes, and Lake Superior, you see. And then when we consider the problems that relate to pollution, and many of you, that is, you can't pick up the papers these days without seeing something that relates to the pollution of fresh water. You see, the pollution of our streams, the pollution of our lakes, and these natural freshwater resources. which really is a very small percent of the total water available. Now, one of the fortunate things, and I think we have to point out what's good about some of these things too, is that water is really almost an indestructible kind of resource. There isn't anything you can do to water that's so bad, but what you can't clean it up. And so the water, even as bad as it may be from the point of view of pollution, if you run it through the right kind of processing, you can bring it right back to potable water that you can drink. And so we're not about to destroy the water. The water will be there, but it's going to cost us a lot to clean it up in order to be able to use it. And one of the things that we'll see, I think, as you go follow this into the future, the water is going to become much more expensive, perhaps more expensive than oil. You know, you think the price of oil is high, but when you begin to follow what the trends are in terms of fresh water and what it's going to cost us to have fresh water in the future, our freshwater supplies are going to be much more valuable, dollar-wise even, than oil and this kind of thing. So that's another kind of resource that we really don't give much thought to. And particularly here in the Cascades, where you have such a wonderful and copious supply of good, clean, fresh water anywhere you hike. You know, you can dip down and drink fresh water. Now, it's a rare situation, and you look at it worldwide. There are very few places, really, in the world where this kind of situation exists. So we're very fortunate right here. Well, to deal with another topic, then, that's a whole topic in itself, is energy. And energy as a resource. Man's ascent, you see, has come about because of his ability to tap cheap sources of energy. He taps the water, he taps the air, and he gets electricity. And then finally, you see, now within just the last 100 or 150 years, he's begun to use extensively the fossil fuels. And what are they? They're simply the energy and the vegetation from millions of years back that have accumulated in the earth, and man digs down, mines them, pumps them out, and burns them, you see. And so you're really then recreating the pent-up energy of millions of years ago. So when you burn coal, you're simply recreating the sunshine that produced that coal maybe 200 million years ago. Now, that again is an exhaustible kind of resource. And when you finally dig up all the coal and you pump out all the oil, then there isn't any more of that kind of sunshine or energy available. That's it. And so we need now, at this point, to be concerned about alternate sources of energy other than fossil fuels. And now the demand for energy is being satisfied, you see, in our own country. 75% or more is coming from the fossil fuels. Actually, as you look at the United States, it's 90%. When you add coal and oil and gas, you see, then this is 90% of all of our energy that we use. And we create our electricity with it for the most part, and so on. So we're drawing very, very heavily, you see, on the bank account, which is stored up in the Earth's crust. But it's exhaustible, just like our own bank accounts. If you pull too hard, you go broke. And this is one of our problems as we look at the future in terms of energy. Now, the renewable kinds of energy, the kind that you can count on into the future, you see, things like solar energy and energy that comes from running water, and so on, where you're dealing with the natural cycles in nature and simply tapping in. But it's hard to get enough energy in this way. And when we want lots of energy, you see, rather than just a small amount of energy, so we're facing some real challenging problems here to solve this kind of thing. Now, the other kind of energy that immediately comes to your mind is nuclear energy, where you do tap into the kinds of energy that are being produced by the sun itself. You simply recreate what's going on at the sun's surface when you deal with nuclear kinds of energy, whether it's fission or fusion, you see. It's all going on at the sun's surface, and if we can do this in our own environment, then that again provides another additional source. But the waste products, you see, are the products that are of major concern, because once we do this, we create certain products in the environment, plutonium and other things, that are very difficult to isolate. And they are not natural, and so these then contaminate the environment. And to the degree that we have to live with that kind of contamination, you see, this then is a hazard. It's a hazard in the biosphere, and so we're concerned about it as a resource. Maybe this is not the best way to go. If we can find some other way to satisfy the energy kind of need. Well, just kind of rolling on here and then let you come in with whatever questions you have. Air, fresh air, I said was one of the other things we have to have. Well, we come from Southern California and we have a problem. And you have a problem too if you come from any large city. And whether it's Omaha or Minneapolis or wherever it is, Chicago is one of the worst. Again, on this. And we're filling the atmosphere with all kinds of wastes that in themselves aren't that bad if you could keep them from not reacting in certain ways. But what happens when you put automobile exhaust into fog and produce what's commonly called a smog, that's not so bad. But when the sun shines on it, then you create a chemical laboratory out of this mixture of gases and water, and you produce a photochemical kind of pollution that is very, very damaging. Ozone kills trees, and all of these other kinds of things that develop in this kind of a chemical mix. And this is where the real problems are, because you can't clean it up easily. And there isn't any way to keep the sun from not shining on it. So when you mix the two and the sun is there, it's going to happen. And that's again a foreign material in the environment, and plants cannot take it. And if the plants can't take it, then the animals have no food. And so the base resource, the basic support, you see, is undermined. And so that's the real concern with smog. It destroys the lettuce crop or the whatever, and various kinds of things, you see, that are very sensitive to the fresh air, clean air. And so we're having this kind of problem. And it's very difficult to isolate it and hide it. Well, in terms of then going, let's go on to the metals. What would our society be if we didn't have metals? And just look around us, you see, and how you got here. If you'd remove the metals, then you see we have a whole different culture. Now the metals, again, are exhaustible kinds of materials for the most part. That is, as in the natural state. Now, and if you just look at the statistical abstract here, and let me just kind of highlight a few of these that you're all familiar with, but you may not have thought about what our relationship is, you see, in terms of some of these things. So I'll just kind of highlight maybe a few of them that can come to mind. Okay. But some of the metals, iron, for example. Iron, this country had one of the greatest sources of iron that any nation has had. But, as you know, the iron ranges in Minnesota, Michigan, Canada, in that area, are pretty well used up in terms of the good iron ore. And now we're down to producing taconite and various kinds of low-grade metal. And when you look at the world in terms of what we produce in terms of iron ore, we're down in the range of about 10 to 12% of the world's supply, that is, that we produce in terms of iron ore. And we use more than any other nation. And so what's the net result? We have to import iron ore. And there's no shortage of iron when you look at it worldwide. About between 5 and 6% of the Earth's crust is made up of iron. But the problem is that it's not concentrated, and if you have to concentrate it by using a lot of energy, then it becomes a very hard material to get at. Now, you know, here in the mine, here at Holden Village, the main ore that they mined was called chalcopyrite. And the thing that the mining company was after was the copper. Now, the chalcopyrite, which was the main ore that was extracted, is one-third sulfur, one-third copper, and one-third iron. And in the end product of this processing, the only thing that was kept was the copper. And even though the mineral was a third iron, this was of no value because it cost too much to get it out. So it's not used. And the sulfur, likewise, for the most part, was not used. Mainly it's vented into the atmosphere, except now the scrubbers and so on have to be put on, and so we are extracting some of the sulfur now, but mainly that has gone to waste. Now, in terms of copper, which is another very important metal in our entire environment, you see, the United States produces about 26% of all of the copper in the world. We're one of the leading nations in producing copper. And we pretty much supply our own demand for copper. And the price fluctuates based on what the substitutes are. You see, if the price of copper gets too high, then what do we use? Then we make automobile radiators out of aluminum. But how about aluminum? When you look at aluminum in terms of the United States, in terms of the ore material that we have in North America, take the whole continent of North America, we produce about 4% of the ore that's made into aluminum, called bauxite. And we have almost none of this. And at the present time, it's not being mined in the United States at all because it isn't feasible. We mine it in Jamaica or in Suriname or some other place in the world, you see, because it's just a lot cheaper to go to a foreign area where it's concentrated, and then we bring it into this country and process it. So we're an important aluminum producer because we have the energy, we have the sources for creating the electricity, and it takes a high energy input, you see, to get aluminum out as a metal. So that's the situation in relationship to that. In zinc, we have a small, but about 7-8% of the world's production in terms of ore, and we use a lot of zinc. And so basically we have in our own country what we have to have, but it's cheaper to import even zinc. And so we import zinc and lead from Australia and various places because it's cheaper to haul it all the way from there to here than it is to produce it in our own country. And so these are the kinds of things that are going on. One of the things we have, and it's rather interesting, in making steel, you see, first of all, you have to have basic iron. That's just raw iron, pig iron, cast iron. But you can't make an automobile motor out of just iron. You have to produce steel. And in order to make iron into steel, you have to have other things to mix with it, which we call the alloys. Now, all of the alloys for steel, except one, are in very short supply on the North American continent. So the United States doesn't have the alloys that it takes to make steel, except for one. We have molybdenum. And it's interesting that right up the trail up here, you know, between Heart Lake and Cloudy Pass, up in that direction, you come to a big hole where they've dug back into the mountain, and that's a molybdenum prospect. And there are some nice chunks of molybdenum ore that have been retrieved from that prospect. And one of the boys here in the village brought one to me here the other day, one of the nicest specimens I've seen of molybdenite. You know, it came from right up the trail here. But that has never been opened up as a real mine, as a source for molybdenum. Mostly our molybdenum comes from Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, down in that area, and it's produced there in sufficient quantity that we supply pretty much the rest of the world with molybdenum. So the United States has one of the major ingredients that makes steel tough and hard, and it's used by every country in the world. And we are the major supplier. Well, fortunately, this is one of the important things to take note of in terms of resources, that they're not equally distributed in all of the continents of the world. And I think that it's beautiful that they are not, you know, because it means that we have to trade things with other people. The tropical areas mainly have the major supplies of aluminum. And the areas up in the Canadian Shield, you see, and in various places, have a lot of silver and gold and various kinds of uranium and the various important industrial metals. And so we have to trade from one place to the other in order to get it together to produce the industrial kind of society that we're interested in trying to preserve, at least in part, so that we can have metals and get them from various parts of the world. This is also a very important thing from the point of view of world politics. You see, this becomes a power base because countries which control natural resources obviously have something then that's wanted, and the dealings that go on. You see, if you begin to look at why certain countries do certain things, look at what the OPEC countries have done in relationship to fuels. You see, they have a corner on that market because they have the reserve. And in our country, we have only a small portion of the total world's reserves of oil. But the Arab countries really have the most part, the biggest part of all of the oil reserves. They in turn do not have arable land. They don't have land that they can raise crops on. So they have to buy food and import it. And they sell us oil. Well, you see, we're having all kinds of interesting political struggles worldwide that relate to the distribution of natural resources from one place to the other And whenever a country, now some of the tropical countries, are trying to get together in terms of aluminum, because this is one of the things all the industrial nations want. And so they're trying to form the same kind of a monopoly that the oil countries have formed. And maybe they'll do it. And the price goes up. Coffee, you see, food things, various kinds of things. If there's any kind of balance, you see, of trade, these kinds of things are played one against the other. And in order to understand world politics, you see, it's very helpful to really see what the power base is. In one case it's oil, another case it's food, another case it's metals and non-metals, you see, diamonds in South Africa, really the only place in the world where there's any major source of diamond. Gold, concentrated in South Africa, where all the turmoil is going on at the present time. And these people wanting to really control their own natural resources. And you really can't blame them for that. That's what we have done. We have taught the rest of the world how to do it. Now they're teaching us. And really, the Arabs didn't do anything that we hadn't already done before with various other kinds of commodities. So it's a trade-off. And when you begin to look at the world now, in terms of the natural resources that man must have to survive, you see, and to keep his culture going, all of these things come into an interplay relationship that is extremely fascinating. I think that, may I just mention one other in terms of a resource in our own country. Certainly one of the things we think is a very important resource are recreational areas, wilderness areas. And here we happen to live, you see, right at the edge of one of the greatest ones in North America, the Glacier Peak Wilderness area. And if we don't preserve these things, you see, these are non-renewable kinds of things. If you destroy the wilderness, that's it. You destroy the life that lives in it, you begin to destroy much of nature's balance. And the problem is, with increasing population, how much of this is safe to disturb, see, without creating major changes in the biosphere and the whole thing. And I think, you know, that as you come right down to it, the greatest resource perhaps we have to deal with is really education. And if we can educate the people as to what lies ahead, you see, the first thing in solving any kind of problem is recognizing that you have a problem. And, you know, I'm very much concerned that the church really becomes more concerned about this aspect. I think that as we look at God's creation and look at the world, look at these resources that have been provided, nothing of this, you see, is man-created. It's all natural, and man is the caretaker, and we have to look at this from a caretaker point of view. We're the custodians. We have the power, and we've been given that. Now the question is, how do we use it in relationship to mankind as a whole? And that's where I would just like to open it up for whatever you would like to ask about it, or what comments do you have? Is this the right kind of thing for the church to be concerned with?
Better head be.
Probably better be. You know, we tend to separate nature from the affairs of the church. If it's natural, there's something wrong with it. This is a concept that I think is dangerous.
Some of the great proponents against nuclear energy in our area were church people.
Proponents?
Against it.
Oh, against
nuclear energy at this time. Not against nuclear energy per se, but going into it so hastily without more research being done. Because one of the greatest concerns, and I say this, I don't know of any that were not church people, strong and working in church areas in the community, was that this waste product that we have, that they're storing, would still be here on earth, if it is still safe and contained, longer than biblical times.
Yeah,
and that what we are doing today is really very little concern to us today if we can keep it contained, but it's generations and generations and generations to come.
Mm-hmm.
And that we should be more concerned with this. I was wondering about your feeling. You touched on it lightly.
Yes,
you came from California.
I did.
All right, and I wondered what your feeling is. And then you said fusion and fission?
Fusion and fission. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you just elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, fusion is not a technological accomplishment at the present time. We can do it in the laboratory, you can do it with a hydrogen bomb, this kind of thing, but there's no control of this at this point. But the technologists and the scientists believe that it is a possible source, say in the year 2000 and beyond. And so it is a potential on the horizon. Not accomplished yet. Fission, you see the splitting of the atom, we can create energy with that. Uranium, various sources of splittable kinds of atoms, you see, where we can get resources out. But we get this waste product, which is dangerous, but perhaps can be contained and handled. But the problems continue to multiply as you add to this into the future, and whether or not you really should rely on this as a rather permanent kind of solution is probably very questionable, because the source of uranium, the source, the fuel, you see, the ore of uranium is limited. And that's limited in the same way that coal is limited or oil is limited. So it may be a solution for a short period of time, maybe 100, 200, maybe 500 years. But then what do you have? At the end of that point, you've exhausted this material and you have a contaminated environment, possibly. Now, we're the guinea pigs. You know, on the other side of the coin, what's the other side of the coin? The other side of the coin is less energy. Less energy available.
And
alternate lifestyle. And maybe, you know, we might be forced to live even like the Swedes live. In Sweden, they use only half as much energy as we use. And they have one of the highest standards of living of any place in the world. And how is that? Well, they don't waste their energy the way we do. It costs more over there, so it's important to save it. And they save half, the half that we waste. Now we say, we're not concerned, don't bother me about it. As long as I can afford it, I don't care. You know, I'll buy it, and I don't worry about the waste end of it.
Say, where does the church enter into it? Isn't right. that where we enter into it in a moral decision? Are we allowed to waste because it's plentiful?
This is my concern. I think we are not. I don't think that we really have this right to be this wasteful.
You say, should the church enter into it? I think there are others besides me that feel that this should be the leadership role of the church.
I think this is a major concern, stewardship of our natural resources should be a major concern of certainly church people, certainly everybody. But the church, it seems to me, ought to be a leader in this. And as I see it, it really isn't happening too much. How do the rest of you see it?
Well, the church has a very poor track record when it comes to scientific pronouncements, and I think they're on very tenuous ground when they try to, like the National Council of Churches says, plutonium is evil and diabolical. That is utterly stupid for them to even take that position, because plutonium is just another element. And for them, they should say radium is evil and diabolical, because that's a bone seeker. And it's a natural product of uranium, and the uranium we're taking out of the ground will eventually not produce radium, which gets in our groundwater and our ecological system. But if we fission it, it then produces plutonium, but we can then in turn fission that.
Mm-hmm.
But the ultimate question that the church has to address itself and is finding difficulty in addressing, it isn't going to do any good to teach people to use half the energy, because that won't solve the problem. You mentioned that we're going to have twice as many people in 30 years and again twice as many people in 30 years more, and the problem will not be solved by saving half. We'll have to go half and half and half,
mm-hmm.
again and again on energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no solution. So what is the ultimate solution? And in my opinion, I think the ultimate solution of the church is to teach us how to limit ourselves in population and numbers in a viable way that we can accept. And
okay.
We haven't found that solution yet.
With our greatest source, we haven't even begun to tap.
The what?
Our greatest source, we haven't even begun to tap.
Well, you're going to tell us that we should tap solar energy, is that what you want to say?
Yeah.
Okay, if we put space, the only way to tap solar energy and get it so that it can supply the mass needs of the massive population is to put space vehicles and collectors in space that orbit the Earth.
Why not?
Because they become diabolical weapons. If you misdirect one of those reflectors, you can burn vast surfaces of the Earth as efficiently as you could with an atomic bomb. They are weapons, very powerful weapons.
Well, I guess I misunderstood what you said.
I agree with you that using solar energy as a source is alleviates the waste problem, but it doesn't alleviate the safeguards problem and the weapons problem. We still have to teach man to be humane and civilized, and solar energy will become just as much a weapon as an atom bomb or a fusion bomb or this possibility of accidents from misdirecting or misusing solar energy can be as difficult to handle as nuclear energy in some respects. Nuclear energy does have the unique problem of handling the fission wastes, but the fission wastes are in essence no different than the natural radioactive waste that we get from God's own creation, uranium and thorium. The Earth is full of radioactive byproducts of those decays.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard from God, if you want to, you know, keep this lifestyle, and then, you know, a lot of the talk, although we have a population problem because we can't keep the lifestyle, maybe changing the lifestyle is something that we can do. There's an interesting statistic that came out just a few months ago from the people who gave the figure originally of the doubling of the population in 30 years, and they said that it won't, from the trends right now and the way they projected, it isn't going to happen. The doubling isn't going to happen, that it's already turned around and natural and then artificial methods of birth control have already turned that, and that the population isn't going to double, that they can see. But just because the you know, if that's so, we still are stuck with a lifestyle that, consumes, you know, incredible amounts of resources. The church has, you know, almost a monopoly or a corner on the market on any values that are not basically survival values. And I think that they can supply something to the thinking about resources that no one else can. That rather than to do what we're doing in order to survive, is to make the changes in order to live rather than just to survive. In the sense that we're forced to do something. Well, we can either be forced to do it or we can choose to pick not a lesser way of life, but a greater way of life, a healthier way of life, and it does not consume as much material. I don't think those values are going to come anywhere but from the church. I really don't. Or be related to Christian values. I think that the world tends to think in survival terms. Well, the church is the one that has the worst survival ethic of all, and it's lived a long time. I think it should be involved in looking at imaginative and really, it sounds crazy to say it with all the gloom of the thing, this subject, but really jolly alternatives to doing things the way we've been doing in the past. I was just one out of maybe it's a crazy idea, but thinking like wondering if the government made it, say, a 20% tax reduction for those people who live within 1 mile of their work or 2 miles of their work. What effect would that have? What effect would that have on the use of oil in this country? As a pretty quick acting, I think, thing that we could do. Whether any politician wants to try.
Crazy. What's so impossible, John?
Hmm?
That's so impossible.
Is it?
I don't think so.
Well, the big cities is where the work is.
Hmm?
I mean, we have the work in the cities, and
well, it's a like, you know, you go out, well, Seattle, and I don't know down in L.A. I know that's a crazy city, but
for sure.
I mean, that's on some other planet sometimes. But like in Seattle or Minneapolis, St. Paul, that area, that you've got right now, you've got about equal traffic going both ways at rush hour. And it might not work in L.A.
Well, it's impossible to find living quarters, you see.
Well, so what I mean is you've got equal traffic both ways. As many are in the city going out to the suburbs as there are outside the city going in. And it didn't used to be this way, but that's about where we're at now, at least in the picture you get from Minneapolis there. I think that the fact that one...
It isn't in L.A.
I think that there's not a single solution that's going to work everywhere. And just because it doesn't work everywhere doesn't mean, you know, that it shouldn't be done.
Well, that's
I think
true.
That
that's true.
Major areas, mm-hmm. Particularly along the, like the East Coast area, where you have a tremendous amount of commuting, and you've got a city maybe, 160 miles long. This, you know, on prairie terms, you've got a city 500 miles long. And there is an immense amount of both the resources used in cars and oil and all sorts of things to keep the house going and so forth. But if there was a significant kind of effort, well, that's just one idea coming on, one idea from, 10 seconds thought, hey, well, that sounds like that might work.
Well, I was just thinking in L.A. terms, the downtown L.A. residences are so enormously expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you can't get anything for $100,000. I mean, it's a shack.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So people who live who work down in L.A. are really going to pay through the nose to live there.
And in Philadelphia, they are giving home. They've got a new homestead thing because the houses are so cheap, and you can move in and take over an old house and rebuild it. And you've got, I don't know the specifics right now. This is, I read it this years ago, but we've got a kind of a reverse homesteading in the city that is,
it's true,
has had tremendous effects. Now that's an imaginative idea. I think that the I think if we were worrying about this stuck in a survival effort, we almost have to think about the problem in ways that that have created the problem in the first place. But I think the church is the only one that can maybe celebrate to the point where there's some humor in this stuff too.
Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm concerned about in this area from a moral point of view is that, and I'm not sure just how much of a motivator moral force is in the country. I'm afraid it's not very much. But like in the area of energy and the things we've been talking about today, it seems to me that it's a crucial element, because if we're not motivated by morality, in the end we may well be motivated by economics. In other words, gasoline will become more and more and more expensive, and houses will become more and more, more expensive, and therefore the few who are rich will then be able to have a monopoly on the vital resources, which it seems to me would be just really spelling the end of life as we know it. I mean, I don't think I would really like to live in a world in which 90% of people couldn't own cars and everybody else drove Rolls Royces or Cadillacs or something, which would be one way of solving the energy problem.
You know, I think we have to think about the third world countries in this regard, because we don't have enough resources in the world to supply all of the rest of the world with the standard of living we have. Mm-hmm. Now that's kind of hard for us to believe, but that's really true. If you tried to do this to the rest of the population, if they were going to have what we have, there just is no way that the resources could provide that.
Even at population zero. I think I know what I was saying was not that we have the pat answers, because it's such a complicated issue, but that if the church takes a leadership, I liked what he said when he said, if we solve it with a moral, from a moral point of view, rather than the almighty dollar, and we know we have the one resource of our faith in God and Christ, even though we are a minority in the world, that if we go to that resource and encourage church people, we always say keep church and state separate, but what we're saying is, well, the church, don't say too much about it or become too involved, let the state solve it. And actually the church is people who work for the state. So if the church takes this leadership and keeps encouraging it and is our well and our fount, that we can go back and be reinforced no matter how we are battered out in the state world, that we can continually go back and get this reinforcement and know that it's a very complicated problem. There is no one way to solve it, and that X and Y's keep changing constantly. But I think we need this reinforcement from our churches and our church leadership, which is all of us people.
How can we do it?
Well, historically, with minor observations, I found that the greatest motivator really isn't moral, it's most likely fear. And I wonder if that probably isn't the answer in this case, in which we'd go back to one of your initial premises, which is education. Because if people are educated, they will become frightened. Yeah. And there's your motivation.
I'd be interested to know how many of you here have read Heilbrunner's book on the human prospect. Do you know that book? I'm sure several of you have. But you might want to read that. Future Shock, you know, is another one that kind of opens your eyes. Heilbrunner's book, and it's on sale up here in the bookstore, here in the village. It's a very dismal kind of thing, and I really don't buy everything Heilbrunner says, but that doesn't mean I shouldn't read it and be knowledgeable about what his base premise is. I think we need to know these things and judge in our own minds whether the base is properly drawn or whether it isn't. But he pictures a very dismal kind of society developing out of this scarcity kind of thing. And he says we'll fight one another, blackmail one another, do all kinds of things which are not the kinds of things we're really talking about in the church.
Yeah, and I think Al Pitch does a lot on Heilbrunner. use that a lot. And I think one thing in that is that the danger of using fear as a motivator is that finally you have to build the fear up a great deal, and finally, in order not to be afraid, you don't do what you maybe should do, but you go fall into a survival ethic. In order to get you to move, you got to make the fear huge, and then when the fear is huge, you'll do anything to survive, and then you get caught in old methods of dealing with problems that I don't think we aren't just stuck with. I think one of the things that Al Pitcher did with Heilbrunner about 2 years ago here with Lifestyle People, he went through this for about a week and a half, through Heilbrunner, and talking about that, and all the time, I think the life, that was at the beginning of the year, not the end of the year, so, but at the beginning of the year, the kids didn't really see what he was really talking about, and they thought he was talking about the resource crisis, and really what he was talking about was freedom, and that, oh boy, now we can do what we should have done. Now, in a sense that we can choose to do what we maybe should have chosen to do. Boy. Negotiate that grammar. a long time ago, and he out of the a week and a half of almost just, dismal forecasting, then getting to the point where this could be one of the big, one of the most hopeful times for man, for quality of life, that we've had in the last, 100 years. The turning point and leap forward in quality of life, where we disassociate quality of life with quantity of life. And that's sort of where his thesis stood a year and a half ago. But if we're still confusing quantity of goods that we have with quality of life, we're going to be stuck. I keep thinking that the lifestyle, the change of the lifestyle, and a free change, one that we get to choose before we're up against the wall, and it's going to be very hard to do anything outside of our natural survival.
Who do you feel should be the leaders in that type of education?
I don't see the impetus or the fire to carry on that, or the power to carry on that type of movement coming anywhere but from the church, because I think that the church is something that it's one of the few institutions that does function on the value system that is not essentially survival, practical survival.
I think one of the most marvelous things that has ever been done by a civilized country is what's done by the United States at the end of World War II, when we took two defeated nations, Germany and Japan, and in a short quarter of a century turned them around into two of the most powerful economic civilizations that now exist in the world and that are competing with us and actually hurting us in making us compete with them. But we, in our own humanity, in our own Christianity, we did that because we were a Christian nation, but the church didn't do it. The church didn't do it. The federal government did it, but the federal government did it because it was a federal government of a Christian nation. And it was an intrinsic property. It was almost a spontaneous happening. And in the sense, the church did provide the leadership, but they provided the leadership because they made a Christian nation, and that's the way a Christian nation acted.
I think I really, the Marx plan and other plans at the time were really...
We're going to be called upon to do the same thing now for the third world countries who want to become industrialized.
Happened to us when we rescued all those emerging nations in Southeast Asia?
I don't know. We did
let
it
them go down the drain. Was that Christianity?
We did what we did, I think. In spite of ourselves, we did it because we just were a Christian nation. But the church didn't get the church didn't get all together and say we get behind the Marshall Plan or the plan for rescuing the economy of
Japan, we, it was something that happened that I'm not sure of exactly how it happened, but I think it happened because of the intrinsic properties of this country. And that intrinsic property was that we basically operate on a Christian ethic.
One of the things I am concerned about is that our constant thinking that we can bring everyone up to our level. And we're not thinking about sharing with the rest of the world. And I think the resources are not there to do with in that sense. And I think here's where we really have to get our thinking in order.
There was a professor from the University of Washington that said that if we bring them up to our style of living, there isn't enough right now for the peoples of the world. That if all the world started to live as we do now, it just can't be.
Well,
it basically has to be lifestyle that we must share.
Yeah, some of us said it before, Costigan. But I'd like to make a pitch for our science and technology committee.
Good, I'm glad you.
And we'll be reporting tomorrow at 4 or something on. In our small way of addressing some of these issues that Nancy appropriately brings up and others of you, and we hope that some of what we do here in this micro community may be an exportable product for other congregations. So you can look forward to that. That makes a pitch for you to come back to that. On the Human Prospect, I would recommend, if you do read Human Prospect, you also read Bremer's Second Thoughts on Human Prospect, which he published sometime after.
Mm-hmm. What's the tendency of the second one, Neil?
I'll show it to you. I'll just 10 pages or something. I'll give the reference at the time of our scientific meeting, or Science and Technology Committee, a report to the constituency.
Yes.
I'd like to bring up just one little four-letter word, care.
Care.
Who cares? I really think that that's something, even if I'm not very knowledgeable, which I'm not, I can care. Mm-hmm. And I can save in little ways. And just, I feel too many people just don't give a damn.
Well,
just don't care.
I think there's a feeling of frustration. The problem is so big, I can't do anything about it.
I know, but you can do that much, and then that adds up to that much.
That's right. If everybody did a little bit.
Right.
And there are many things. Leadership.
Every little bit helps.
And education.
If I didn't believe that, I'd get very depressed.
Now, I think we have to live on hope that there is some way of solving this problem. We have to hope that. And we have to, I think, be along with Desjardins, who really says that, as you look at the future, the phenomenon of man really is that he can understand what he's doing today, what the result is going to be tomorrow. You see, that is a great gift we have. And if we can put ourselves in the position of saying, what are we doing to our world today? And if we change that, that also changes tomorrow. And if we do care, and if we do want to change, then, you see, it can happen. That's my feeling. And I have to feel optimistic about this. It's a very depressing kind of thing, and you could be so turned off about this that you say, well, it's just hopeless, we're down the drain, let's just live it up, and that's the end. And to some degree there is some of this philosophy that is among us in society, but I think we have to carry the torch for really trying to educate, trying to solve, trying to care, and really do something about it. Now, I think we have probably exhausted our time. We said an hour, and I think we've taken a few more minutes than that. But any of you that want to stay on and continue this until the bell rings, why, I don't have anything else to do between now and 5:30, and I think we have a few more minutes, so feel free to go or ask any further questions or make any comment you wish.
I suppose you all read articles on landscape as much as the National Geographic. And then there have been several, well, in the Saturday Review and others. You know we're in a new spring for it, don't you? Colonization of outer space. The Earth isn't the only place in the universe that God built, you know.
Okay.
I'm going to predict that the grandchildren of his grandchildren are going to see a lot of different things.
Long before them.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Utilization of the sea. We hear about that all the time. The resources right. in the sea.
The dimensions of man's resources are expanding.
Exactly.
Along with
I don't think we should
the
be
population.
Too pessimistic.
Well, that's my point. I think we should be active in finding solutions.
We should be cautious and careful, that's true.
But above all, we should not waste.
Well, I agree with that. But I do strongly feel, having lived in Southeast Asia, one of the countries, you talk about saving the third world, who cared? They all got out on the streets and held banners, the students and the young people. Finish it up in Vietnam, you know. But what about little Cambodia? Well, nobody cares. The whole little country of Cambodia wasn't even a fraction as big as the city of New York. So it doesn't matter. One more country down the drain. You see, nobody cares. They're all murdered off. But, I mean, if we are going to be a Christian nation toward one country, and we started out being a Christian nation toward that country, we ought to try to be consistent about that. We can't level it. I guess that's going to take quite a lot of millennia to level off the whole world evenly, you know. And they probably wouldn't want our standard of living if they could have it.
No.
I just think a couple of years ago when we had the pressure of energy crisis and we were educated, and then some of it was forced upon us because the gas stations were only open every other day for certain letters to get it. But in that, we had a type of education that I feel again could have been encouraged at the church level, that to make us aware of it, to make us aware to do more reading, to find out about this, that we as Christian leaders should become more knowledgeable in this, and I don't mean brilliant, but just the facts of why we're doing it. And it was an enjoyable type of life. Meetings were cut back, you didn't have to buy this and you didn't have to buy that, and we are all human in that, this idea of success, consuming more and having more, and that your children should have this, and they should have dancing lessons and piano lessons and the little league and all these things. But many of these things were curtailed, and we had more family life, and it was beautiful. And I, for one, hated to see this disappear.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not strong enough to fight the nation, and I'm not strong enough to fight this whole neighborhood and whole community I live in and deprive these little boys of all these other things that are going on, because they've got to live in the world that it is. So I think this is what I'm saying when I say education. We need support groups. We need to support one another. And that has to come from a moral conviction of knowing we are sharing, we are caring, we are giving good reasons why maybe population should not expand. Why some want large families and some don't want other families. Encourage them to come to a moral decision. Help them, show them how.
Very good. Any other comment? Well, thank you for coming, and we'll don't forget our science report tomorrow afternoon.